Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting.
Thank you.
God save the Honorable Court, that is the state of Texas.
Thank you, be seated. This morning, the court has four causes on its oral submission docket. They are consolidated into three arguments. The first argument will be Kim Petroleum Corporation and certain member companies at the Institute of London Underwriters versus Questor Drilling Corporation and Fibro Energy USA Incorporated from Wharton County, consolidated for argument with Weber Energy Corporation versus Gray Wolf Drilling Company from Brazoria County. The second argument will be N. Ray Alcatel USA Incorporated versus DSC Communications Corporation, an original proceeding. And the third argument is in the interest of OGM, a child from Harris County. In each of these matters, the court has allotted 20 minutes for oral argument. The petitioner or relator may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. We will take a brief recess in between each argument and conclude the arguments before lunch. The clerk of the court is taping these arguments, and you may purchase a copy of these tapes for a nominal fee by making application with the clerk. Court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioners in Kim Petroleum versus Questor and Weber Energy versus Gray Wolf.
May it please the court, Mr. Chris Evans and Mr. Lyle Rathwell will present argument for the petitioners. The petitioners have reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Evans will open with the first 9 minutes, and Mr. Evans will also present the rebuttal.
May it please the court. My name is Chris Evans. I'm the attorney for Kim Petroleum Corporation and its underwriters in their case against Questar Drilling. Our case has been consolidated this morning with the Weber Energy case, and Mr. Lyle Rathwell will step up immediately after me to discuss his case. For my allotted time this morning, I would like to talk about two issues. First, I'd like to address the contractual indemnity issues. And then second, I would like to reach the issues that are unique to the Kim Petroleum case, and that being the waiver of segregation issues that were addressed by the court below. First, with respect to the contractual indemnity issues, the contract before this court and before the court below between Questar Drilling and Kim Petroleum met all of the requirements of the Texas Oilfield Anti-Indemnity Act. The contract required and stated in writing that the parties agreed to provide insurance to support their mutual indemnity obligation. By agreeing to provide some amount of insurance, even if it was just $1 each, the parties agreed, as by definition, that they would provide equal amount of insurance at some level. The way the contract is worded tracks the language of the statute. The statute starts out with Part A, Section 127.05, Part A, and says the parties will agree in writing to provide insurance to support their indemnity obligation. That was done. Everybody agreed. The second part says what the parties have agreed in equal amounts will be the cap or the limit on the amount of indemnity that the parties can enforce. The statute assumes that an agreement has been reached. The statute does not say the parties will specifically agree to an equal amount and that will be their limit. The statute, the wording of the statute assumes an agreement is already reached. So the question is, why would the legislature write the statute making that assumption? And the answer is obvious. Part A above dealt with the agreement. Part A requires the agreement to be in writing that the parties support their indemnity with insurance. And therefore, the legislature could do the math just like anybody else. And it knew that if the parties agreed to provide some amount of insurance, at some level, that insurance would be equal. And Part B is simply to put a cap on that, to say whatever that level is, whatever the agreement was in terms of the insurance at equal amounts, that will be the amount that the parties can enforce their indemnity obligation. So once the statutory requirements are met by the language of the contract, then the statute is set aside, and what we have left and what the court below had left to deal with was a contractual interpretation issue. An issue of what is this contract, what was the intent of the parties with respect to their indemnity obligation as far as the amount of insurance each would provide. The reason that we have that is because Questar Drilling provided our client, Ken Petroleum, with a form contract that did not have a space in it for Ken to write in the amount of insurance that it was agreeing to provide. It clearly agreed to provide insurance because that was in writing, but there was no space for it to put in the amount. The testimony for the summary judgment purposes was that Questar had asked for that information, we'd been glad to provide it. Ken Petroleum provided $6 million of insurance, Questar provided $3 million. So there is an ambiguity in that respect. But courts deal with ambiguities in Texas all the time, and the way they deal with them is they use the contractual interpretation rules to look at the contract and try and get to the intent of the parties. In this case, the clearest contractual interpretation rule to get to the intent of the parties is what did they actually do? In this case, they provided $3 million and $6 million, and an equal amount at that level is $3 million. And so that is the most clearest interpretation of what the intent of the parties was as far as what the equal amount of insurance they agreed in writing they would provide. With respect to the other aspects of the case that are unique to the Ken Petroleum case, the Court of Appeals never addressed the language in the contract that provides a very limited waiver of subrogation. That is, in the contract, the parties agreed, Ken Petroleum agreed, to waive subrogation for its underwriters only in circumstances where Ken Petroleum owed Questar indemnity. And that's what the words in the contract said. The Court of Appeals transmuted that into a general waiver of subrogation for all purposes. The Court of Appeals did not address the language itself, did not say why the words that require a limited waiver turned the contract into a general waiver. They simply left that unclear and unstated. And therefore, it is important for this court to address that issue because parties need to be able to contract freely to provide a limited waiver of subrogation when that is, in fact, their intent. Therefore, the parties, this court should address the issue and allow parties to know what language that they would put into a contract that would make it clear that there was only a limited waiver of subrogation intended by the parties. That is the key to the waiver of subrogation issue is that the parties, there is an intention, in order to have a waiver, it has to be an intentional relinquishment of a known right. And there is clearly no intentional relinquishment of a right with respect to the waiver language in this contract. The parties clearly intended a limited waiver, and that is what should be enforced in this case. I will reserve any time with respect to the other issue, the petition by Questar Drilling Corporation with respect to its DTPA issues for my rebuttal comments.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Honorable members of the Supreme Court, my name is Donald Rockwell. I represent Weber Energy in the companion case, operator also seeking indemnity under the anti-indemnity statute. In fact, of our case, Weber Energy purchased $16 million of insurance. Gray Wolf Drilling purchased $16 million of insurance, equal amounts. The essence of the statute was support your indemnity obligation with insurance, and then the indemnity obligation will be enforced to equal amounts. Where we believe that the Fifth Circuit went astray, and the First Court of Appeals of Texas and the 13th Court of Appeals followed the Fifth Circuit guidance, was a lack of or address to the fundamental issue of what this statute seeks to protect. It seeks to protect against an economic burden on an indemnifying party. That evil is protected against by the application of insurance. That makes the contract valid and the indemnity obligation valid and the evil killed. Allocate your indemnity obligation to insurance and then enforce the indemnity obligation based on the amount of insurance that is actually obtained. The Fifth Circuit has chosen to argue and opine that the validity of the indemnity agreement is based on the amount of the insurance. That is not the way the industry works. The IEDC has filed an amicus brief before this court stating that that's not the way the industry works. And by the act of the legislature in 1999, the legislature stated that's not the way the industry works. The purchase of equal insurance, albeit existing in our case, is very rare in the oil and gas industry. The risks associated with an operator, owner of a well are remarkably different from the risks associated with the drilling of the well to the drilling contractor.
But couldn't the legislature have recognized that and by statute adopted your lowest common limit test? I mean, isn't there a reason why they put equal in there?
Yes, there is. The equal limit was designed to protect the making insurance schemes. If an operator determines what the risk is for a particular well, that operator will specify the amount of insurance that the drilling contractor should have, notwithstanding the amount of insurance that the operator has. The operator may have $500 million. So by the legislature, at the request of the industry, said, let's enforce the indemnity up to an equal amount. So that's what equal says. If you support your indemnity with insurance, when there's a claim or a need to indemnify, we'll look to the insurance and apply the lowest common denominator. What is the equal amount? Now, what the Fifth Circuit interpreted was, you have to look and agree and purchase equal insurance. And that just isn't the case. And so the legislature, recognizing that the Fifth Circuit was wrong in interpreting its statute, remediated its statute by saying now it's open to whatever insurance is obtained. At no time did the industry, when they went to the legislature or when the legislature passed the statute, did they intend for the parties to specify specific limits of insurance in the contract itself. The legislature hadn't determined what the scope of the protection is. They hadn't stated, other than in unilateral indemnities, what the protection needs to be. That's between the contracting parties to decide based on the amount of insurance that they obtain. The Government Code Section 311.023 gives a mandate to this court to construe the statute with a number of factors. One of them is the object to be obtained. The object to be obtained is allocation of risk between the contracting parties at the well site. Then, for protection against an economic burden, shift that risk to a policy of insurance. That has been obtained. The circumstances under which the statute were enacted. Go back to 1973, insurance wasn't available. That was the premise why the statute was enacted in the first place. There was no insurance available to the oil and gas industry to drill wells. In 1989, when the statute was changed, insurance industry had caught up and insurance was readily available. That's when we saw the change from just an indemnity agreement to a distinction between unilateral and mutual indemnities. Now the Fifth Circuit put a lot of emphasis on the dropping of the word available and the insertion of the word equal. The background behind that had to do with the change between unilateral and mutual indemnities. And again, the protection of the making insurance. Now, in light of the Fifth Circuit's opinion, the legislature has gone back and said, we'll go back to the freedom of contract to the parties. We're not going to require the parties to buy equal insurance because that just doesn't exist in the industry, and we'll let all the insurance be available. Again, any insurance that is obtained is going to be available to the indemnity agreement, unless the parties specifically agree to limit the amount of insurance.
If the reason for the Oil Field Operators Anti-Indemnity Act is to prevent a big party from coercing a small party into indemnifying the big party for its own negligence, why wouldn't that apply to coercion into buying someone else buying the insurance and leaving the big party not having to buy insurance and forcing the little party to buy all the insurance, which might happen if we interpret your statute to say, well, it's just covered up to whatever the smallest amount of insurance is or whatever.
Well, it's a situation that may exist. It's certainly not in the facts before this court and in the cases before this court. But in a situation like that, assuming it was an operator that did that, that operator would be exposing itself just like the contractor would be exposed. Because of the express language of the statute, the indemnities are enforced equally. So if the operator chooses not to buy insurance for whatever reason, then the contractor's indemnity obligation would be nil. And that is the purpose and the essence of the statute. Not to make sure that there's adequate insurance, but to ensure that if there is an indemnity obligation, it'll be passed on to insurance. And that's where the distinction between 127.05A and 127.05B falls. A is the validity requirement. That's the evil. Make sure that the indemnity obligation is supported by insurance. And then go to B and say, now, what are we going to enforce that indemnity to? What is the scope of that indemnity? That's the amount of insurance that the parties have in equal amounts. The consequences of the ruling of the Fifth Circuit are particularly in the facts of our case. Weber Energy purchased $16 million of insurance, identical amounts. They agreed to provide insurance in the contract, and they did provide insurance in the contract. What else can a company do other than meet the very purpose and the intent of the statute? The IEDC has come forward. It was an IEDC contract. They have come forward and said the Green decision was wrong. The industry collectively came forward to the legislature and said the Green decision is wrong. The First Court of Appeals and the 13th Court of Appeals followed the Green decision. That is why we say that those cases must be overruled and the statute should be enforced to the true intent and the essence of the statute. Enforce the indemnities up to the amount of insurance that each party has in equal amount.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Ms. Macy Reisner-Stokes and Mr. Mark Stratton will present argument for the respondent. Ms. Reisner-Stokes will open with the first 10 minutes.
Actually, Your Honor, Mr. Stratton.
May it please the court, my name is Mark Stratton. I represent Great Wolf Growing Company. This is a case in which this court must decide whether two similar, but not identical, IEDC form contracts that were not drafted to specifically comply with Texas law. Comply with the Texas law involving the oil field anti-indemnity statute.
As a practical matter, just as a practical matter, forget the language of the statute. What's wrong with adopting the lowest common limit test in terms of the purpose behind the statute?
Well, adopting the lowest common limit test ignores the language of the statute.
Well, but I said, without the language of the statute, with the purpose behind the statute, what would be wrong as a policy matter with adopting that test?
Well, because the policy behind the anti-indemnity statute and behind all indemnity strictly construe them against validity. The anti-indemnity statute has said the policy is to protect contractors from indemnity agreements, indemnity obligations.
But if we adopted the lowest common limit test, wouldn't we just be enforcing the agreements that they've reached?
But in order to have the agreements be valid in the first place, there has to be a valid indemnity agreement, and that has to comply with the statute.
Why would the legislature care if the operator had more insurance than the drilling contractor?
Well, the legislature only cares because it's said in the statute, we are going to require you to have equal amounts of...
What's the rationale for saying Exxon, if you have $16 million, you can't enter into a valid contract with a drilling contractor? if the contractor only gets $3 million?
Well, it's to protect this drilling contractor from obligations where they would have to go out and buy 16.
But Exxon agrees. I'm happy with $3 million, but I need $16 million for my own purposes. Why does the legislature care? Why should they care?
Well, the legislature is caring because they have said in the statute that we do care.
But under your interpretation, wouldn't you require then the smaller drilling company to go out and try to get $16 million worth of insurance in order to get that contract with Exxon?
Yes, they'd have to go out and try to get the insurance. But in this case...
Well, that hurts the contract.
Well, in this particular case, there is no obligation by Weber to go out and buy any insurance. If we look at the contract in question, the contract just provides that it would be supported by available insurance.
How do you distinguish the Dallas Court of Appeals decision in Maxis? They decided this specific issue against you, didn't they?
Well, Maxis was a case where the Supreme Court held that Texas law didn't apply. It was actually Kansas law that should apply. And the Supreme Court in that case said, we're not going to make a decision about whether the anti-indemnity statute was violated. The Dallas Court of Appeals, in that case, was interpreting the statute, the pre-1989 statute, not the post-1989 statute. And therefore, they didn't reach these same issues.
But on the sheer contract interpretation, the Dallas Court did reach the question of whether the operator, under language that's very similar to your contract, had agreed to procure insurance and said yes. That language obligated them to get insurance.
Well, I don't think it was ever argued in the Maxis case that the operator was required to purchase the insurance, was required to procure insurance. In this case,
it says specifically we hold that the indemnity provisions require the operator that they agreed in writing would support its obligation by liability coverage. Isn't that the issue in this case?
Well, that's correct. But in this case, there's nowhere in the contract where Weber is required to procure insurance. The statute specifically provides that if a party, in order for it to be valid, the parties must agree in writing that the indemnity obligation will be supported by liability insurance to be furnished by the indemnitor. So it has to say Weber is going to provide the insurance coverage to support the indemnity obligation. In this case, they did say they will be supported by insurance coverage. But that doesn't say who's going to provide it.
So which contractor and operator hereby agree will be supported either by available liability insurance or self-insurance.
That's correct. But it doesn't say who's going to provide it. For instance, this could be, Weber could comply with this by having Gray Wolf buy an OCP policy or an owner's contractor protection policy, rather than them themselves purchasing it. This is specifically what the legislature is trying to prevent in this case. They could also have Gray Wolf buy a separate policy, other than the $16 million policy, and make them additional insured. Now that would be okay under the Dresser Industry case, but it still doesn't make the indemnity provision valid. Because this indemnity provision, nowhere in this contract is Weber required to purchase any insurance to support the indemnity obligation, this court should find, shouldn't even get past A. But if they do, Section 127.005 clearly provides that each party must agree to provide equal insurance. In this contract, there's simply no provision whereby Weber is required to provide the same coverage and the same amount of coverage to Gray Wolf that Gray Wolf is required to provide. There's no evidence of any agreement in either the Kent Petroleum case or this case that any particular amount of insurance or the same extent of coverage was contemplated. Weber first says this is not a requirement for validity, but it's only a limitation. It's not a limitation. It's specifically incorporated as a requirement for validity into Section 127.05A. It contains a Section B contains a provision whereby each party has agreed to provide in equal amounts to the other party as indemnity. Again, you have the tracking of the language to the other party as indemnity, and it's supposed to be furnished by Weber. Going and taking the lowest common denominator or the lowest common limits has this court looking after the fact at whether this is a valid indemnity agreement. Weber has argued that it should have three steps in which to make a determination as to whether the indemnity agreement is invalid. First, it must meet the definition of a mutual indemnity agreement. I agree with that. Second, it must provide in writing that the indemnity obligations will be supported by insurance. Well, this doesn't comply with the provision that says it has to be provided by the indemnitor. Third, they say, look at the scope of the indemnity obligation will be equal to the common limits of insurance obtained by the parties. This requires waiting until after the fact, after there's an incident, to make a determination as to what the limits are. The best way to make a determination about whether this is a valid indemnity obligation is to be able to look at the language of the contract, take a look at it. Don't have to go out and look and see outside of the contract to see if they bought equal insurance or to see if somebody has provided insurance at all. Now, the Green case, I think is very informative in that the Green case involved an IADC contract, which was specifically, the Texas law was specifically discussed in the contract. In the two contracts that are issued here today, that's not the case. In fact, there is a note on each of the contracts that says this is a form contract and is suggested form only, and use of this form or any variation of the form shall be at the sole discretion and risk of the user parties. They go ahead to warn people to make sure that this contract complies with the law of the state and the jurisdiction where they are using it. In this case, the specific language of the contract does not comply with the Texas Oilfield Indemnity Statute. In conclusion, Texas law, Texas courts have frowned upon these risk-shifting provisions. Particularly, the legislature has said in oilfield contracts with indemnity agreements, you have to strictly comply with the language of the statute in order for it to be valid. I would ask this court to hold that these contracts in question do not strictly comply with the statute and find the indemnity provisions in them to be invalid.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Justice O'Neill, you asked what's wrong with just implying an agreement as to equal amounts, even though it's not expressly in the contract. I think there's several problems with that. First of all, I think what the legislature did in 1989, the legislative history makes clear that the first version of the Senate, they just took out the cap because, as Mr. Rathwell knows, insurance was much more easy to get than it had been in 1973. And then it was just the available language with no equal amount. But then when it got to the House decided to take out the available term and put in the agreement of the equal amount. And we have to assume that they did it for a reason. I believe the reason is that they said, okay, we're going to say the sky's the limit as you agree, but as a countervailing protection, we're going to make it have to be equal, so that operators are not going to be able to impose unreasonable indemnity obligations, which even though they're backed by insurance, a huge requirement, because
what
they'll
if they,
have to provide
what if they
the
are,
amount.
What if they are equal? What if they actually do go out and get equal amount? They just don't put it in the contract. How is the legislature's purpose and the statute furthered by requiring it to be expressed in contract.
Well, I think the problem is that even though that's true in the Weber case, it's not true in ours, and it's not true in most situations. I think the parties are in agreement that the way this industry works is the companies buy their insurance to cover a whole year, and then that will cover several jobs, either short-term drilling jobs, but maybe several in the same year. So they don't go out and buy a new policy for each contract. And the problem is that if you say, we're going to do it after the fact, it becomes uncertain, and you have to wait until an accident happens to really get down to what everybody had. And in our case, I think, illustrates that perfectly. Kim Petroleum pointed to no less than 3 years of equal amounts of insurance, $1 million, $3 million, and $6 million was part of the deal. Now they pay $3 million. Another problem is, when do we determine what these equal amounts, what point in time do we freeze it and say, what insurance do you have? Do we do it at the time of the contract? What happens if one of them decreases the amount of insurance they have by the time of the accident? They still should be committed to that amount they had back at the time of the contract.
Aren't those fact questions under ambiguous contract?
Well, see, I don't think there is an ambiguity, Your Honor. I think that these contracts, there wouldn't be an ambiguity. They're not incomplete if it weren't for the act requiring this agreement, and there's just simply no agreement of equal amounts. I don't think the fact
What if there's an oral agreement that she's not expressed in the contract?
Well, Your Honor, I think that might be a different case. I personally think that the statute, by the fact that B is incorporated into A in 127.005, requires that it be in writing, and I think that better effectuates the legislature's purpose in preventing inequity to have it in writing, even if it's not in the contract, incorporated by reference.
Do you agree that your contract does express some intent on both sides that they would get insurance? There's some obligation on both sides to obtain insurance.
Yes, Your Honor. We have not argued that Ken was under no obligation to provide any insurance. We just believe that they were never required to provide a specific amount, and there was no meeting of the minds to provide an equal amount. I mean, the statute requires an agreement, which is part of the problem with implying it after the fact from parole evidence. I mean, you have to have a meeting of the minds. The term mutual does not mean equal in the dictionary, and I don't think you can equate it as such. And even if that were true, why would there be a Section B? Equal agreements would be implied in every single mutual indemnity contract, and that's just not the case. And I don't think we can imply an agreement from the automatic amendment language that they've argued in their briefs. I think that automatic amendment language, in our case, ours was a IABC form contract that was revised in February 1986, before the 1989 Act even came out. So neither the form makers nor our parties, who both of our negotiator and Kim Petroleum testified, they had never even heard of the amendment act when they negotiated these contracts. So I don't think that reflects any intent to meet the 1989 statute. I can't think of another context where we say an agreement to agree in the future to comply with the future law to satisfy a statutory requirement. Your Honor, Justice Owen, you asked a question about Maxis. It is true that Maxis was applying the pre-1989 Act. I don't believe that Maxis was rightly divided even under the old Act. I think the old Act used terms like agree and require and contemplated that people would save the amount of insurance in the contract. And there's the same problems with uncertainty under the old Act if you don't state it. And there's nothing particularly onerous about requiring the parties to save the amount of insurance. We don't maintain that I have to go out and buy a $60 million policy, and so does the operator. You can have different amounts of insurance coverage, in fact, as long as you commit the same amount to cover your indemnity in the contract. And that's not an onerous requirement. And the fact that there was an outdated form contract that the IABC didn't change since 1993, in my mind, doesn't justify disregarding the plain language.
But doesn't it create problems within the industry? For example, someone raised the question of Exxon. If they have a $16 million sort of umbrella policy over all their wells, and they contract with a drilling contractor who has a $500,000 indemnity, then doesn't it require them then to get $16 million? And doesn't that fly in the face of the purpose?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe it does. I believe that the parties negotiate the amount of insurance that they are going to have back their indemnity, and a Exxon and the drilling contractor can agree on that amount, $500,000. If not, then the drilling contractor would, I assume, have to agree to get more. But there's no reason it has to be the same amount that Exxon has. I mean, they can pick the amount and then commit their insurance to it. It doesn't have to be the most that one party has. And the problem with this lowest common amount of insurance, other than the unworkability of it, is why didn't the legislature say that in 1989 if that's what they meant? That would have been a simple matter. And I disagree that the 1999 Act reflected any legislative intent that the prior interpretations in Green, Weber, and our case misinterpreted their former language. The legislative history is very sparse. This was something that was sent out of the Senate committee on the last possible day. There's no testimony in the Senate. And the legislative history only notes that there's a federal court that has interpreted this language to mean to require an agreement of equal amount. The very next sentence is, we amend the statute to say the amount obtained for the benefit of the other party as indemnity, and then it says, comma, not an agreement of equal amount. There's no indication the legislature thought they were wrong. If anything, I think it's proof that the courts have properly interpreted it, and they decided to change the language, in part because of lobbying by the IADC and the Texas Oil and Gas Industry, Association, excuse me. One other point that Mr. Evans touched on is that we're the ones who drafted the contract, and so we ought to, it ought to be construed against us. First of all, we didn't draft it, it's a form contract. Ken English, the president of Kim Petroleum, testified that he had drafted these contracts, he had used these contracts in 25 to 30 other dealings with drilling contractors, not just Questore. There was undisputed testimony that the way it worked is they had a conversation over the phone, negotiated the terms. Doug Pillow, our representative, filled in the blanks, sent it to Ken English, who then made further modifications. There's no indication that we controlled the contract or its terms. There's no evidence or even a pleading of a confidential relationship that would place a duty on us to inform Ken Petroleum of the law or to ask them about their insurance. And the statute is not written to impose an obligation on the contractor to do so, and in my mind, that would be contrary to their intent to protect contractors. If I may just briefly touch on the DTPA issue, I believe if the court reviews the First Amendment petition in Volume 1 of the transcript, it's clear that there was no misrepresentation outside of the contract about what the terms of the contract were or the validity of the contract. All that Kim Petroleum pleaded was the terms of the contract itself constituted a misrepresentation, that drafting the contract without a blank for Kim Petroleum's insurance and not asking Kim Petroleum for its insurance was a misrepresentation, and that our post-accident representations that we would perform under the contract were misrepresentations. None of these constitute a Section 1746B12 misrepresentation about what an agreement confers. And I think your decision in Crawford forecloses any predication of a misrepresentation in terms of the contract itself. It's clear that Ken Petroleum pleaded this as an alternative to its breach of contractual indemnity contract, that if the contract is void, then by signing the contract, the misrepresentation.
Any questions?
Thank you very much.
You, counsel.
How do you respond to Ms. Stokes' argument that your interpretation of the application of the lowest common limit test would harbor uncertainty in the industry?
Your Honor, I suppose you could apply that to any contract in the state of any type that has some sort of ambiguity. There are a lot of contract interpretation rules that the courts follow because a lot of lawyers can't draft a contract without an ambiguity.
But what would be wrong with just requiring them to put the amounts in the agreement itself? I mean, as a practical matter, what would be wrong? If they do that, wouldn't there be more certainty in terms of what the obligations were?
That's true, Your Honor. I mean, certainly there would be if they put in, more language in there. I think that the point is there are a lot of contracts that have ambiguities in them. So if you're going to follow that logic, the next logical step is just to say any contract that doesn't specifically set out exactly what the party's intents are is void, and we're not going to bother to enforce it. And so that's a contractual interpretation issue, and the policy of the courts in Texas up to now has been, no, we're going to try and carry out the party's intent, even if they weren't good about specifically setting out in their written document what their agreement was. And so we're going to go to rules of contract interpretation, and that's all we're doing in this case. We have an ambiguity, we're going to contract interpretation rules. I think the key to the argument that the parties are making is the legislature intended for this type of contract to shift the burden to the insurance companies. Once the burden is shifted to the insurance companies, the legislature's problems are solved, and so therefore all we're talking about is contract interpretation. To understand this, what you have to see is that what Questar and what Grey Wolf are trying to say is, because the operator did not give us information that we didn't ask for, therefore we get out of our obligation, even though we have insurance to protect ourselves from the obligation, which is what the legislature wanted. It basically turns the legislation into an insurance protecting scheme as opposed to an anti-indemnity scheme. And that's not what the legislature was intended. Clearly, the legislature intended to allow the burdens to be shifted to the insurance company.
Any other questions? Thank you. That concludes the argument on the first matter. The court will now take a brief recess.
Yeah,